Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert-Day is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up this week, Boris Johnson unveiled his plans for turning Britain green by 2050. What's in the net zero strategy, and who will foot the bill to make our homes, our cars, and our lives more eco-friendly? Gas boilers are out, heat pumps are in, but does the £5,000 grant go far enough? And what even are they? Also, under green mortgages, will some struggle to sell their homes while others will have to fork out thousands of pounds? Plus, we reveal the rate on NS&I green savings bonds. Don't get too excited, by the way. Spoiler alert. How much the state pension is to go up by sans triple lock? Again, probably don't get too excited by that either. And we ask, is Bitcoin back? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, you'd never guess, a major climate conference is taking place in the UK in a couple of weeks. The government has got the big green marker pen out and released a number of policies designed to help in the fight against climate change. Much of the focus on our homes. So what are the plans and how will they affect us? Who will pay for it, etc.? But first, as part of all of that, green savings bonds from NS&I. Lee, you were not here last week, but we touched on that. They were announced, I believe, in the March budget. World first. We've been waiting with anticipation as to what the rate of interest will be. We have the news hot off the press. Lee, are you excited?
Georgie, these bonds are green, but they're lean and mean, unfortunately, in terms of the rate. 0.65% over a three-year fix is not going to get pulses racing. I don't think it's going to really attract the £15 billion that they're thinking this might attract. Look, I understand it's run by NS&I. These green bonds are going to be around to fund projects. And I think that they've kind of really undercooked the goose here, because at the end of the day, you can get a three-year fix at 1.81%. You can get an easy access rate at 0.65%, exactly the same as this three-year rate. I understand that it has to be priced properly, because if you go market leading, we have an issue like the pensioner bonds back in 2015. But just in comparison, that was offering 4% over 3 years. And that was one of Britain's biggest ever financial product sales in the end. Websites crashed, phone lines jammed. I don't think it's going to be the case this time around. And actually, the government points to some research suggesting that people aren't that bothered about the rate if the money's going somewhere good, but it doesn't actually specify how low returns people are willing to take. That, you know, it's basically a penalty on your cash. And then today we've had talks of 5% inflation. Money's earning 0.65% over 3 years. I personally thought it would go somewhere between 1 and 1.5. Again, which wouldn't make it market leading. In fact, nowhere near. But it's still, I think when you start going under 1%, I think people just kind of not that interested. The one good thing about these bonds, though, George, right aside, is that once the money's in, you will see which projects your money will be going to, which I think is a good idea. You know, I think that's that sometimes the problem with trying to green your finances, right, is that you put money into something ESG or whatever, and you don't really tangibly see where that money's going, and you're kind of a little bit clueless as to what projects that's funding and things. So that's a nice little element to it. But I was speaking to James Blower, a longtime friend of this
savings guru,
the savings guru, and he said that at those rates, the government would be lucky to rake in £100 million, let alone £15 billion. The rate is just far too low. So, yeah, it's not that great. And also, George, the other thing to point out here as well is that NS&I has premium bonds. Premium bonds underlying rate is 1%. I think the average person on the street, if you tell them which one they would prefer to put their money in, I think I know what the answer is. So it is one of those things. You've got to price it properly to attract the amount of money that you want to get in, while balancing the interests of taxpayers and that kind of stuff. But it just doesn't feel like it's going to have any kind of impact. In my mind, that's what I think.
It's the 3 year that does it for me. But Lee, there are alternatives if you want to, you know, be ethical with your money and savings. I'm thinking Triodos do a 1 year fix for it's 0.4%, but at least you can move it around after that year. And, you know, with Inflation, as you said, could hit 5%. Your money's being eroded. And with interest rates being priced in a rise, what, this year and perhaps spring next year, you know, we could see savings rates edge up. So you'd be losing out on a fair bit of interest, wouldn't you? If you have your 0.65 for 3 years. Oof.
Exactly, George. And actually, three-year rates anyway are quite a niche product. You know, most people wouldn't go beyond the two-year fix in terms of savings because, you know, we're talking about potential base rate hikes, for example, in the coming months, which might actually mean that savings rates nudge up a little bit. You know, so we've got that factor at play as well. But you're right. I mean, fixing for 3 years, again, it's just a bit of a strange time. But I do understand that element because you've got to know how much money's coming in and being able to have enough time frame to get it out to fund these projects. But yeah, I mean, you can get a three-year fix with Gatehouse Bank at 1.78% and they'll plant a tree for you in UK.
Yeah, exactly.
So you tangibly, you can see that tree is being planted. You know, that is an actual thing that's happening when you put your money into that account. So yeah, it's a toughie, Georgia. I think that I'd be surprised if this really does take off, especially in the kind of, with that inflation looming, base rates potentially going up.
Do you think it's going to go up though, Lee? Is that your prediction, look, in a couple of weeks, you know, because it's only on the market for 3 months, isn't it?
The green bonds. Yeah, I mean, we'll see. I think that the government would be wise to see what happens in the first couple of weeks, because the first couple of weeks inevitably would be where the most interest is. And if the interest isn't high, you know, from people putting money in, I think they might have to adjust it accordingly. Mm. And the other thing is, you know, you were talking there about Triodos and I was talking about Gatehouse. You know, if you also want to green your finances, there's funds out there, you know, there's investment projects out there in which, you know, specialize in this, and there's more of them coming onto the market all the time because interest in this sort of green area is growing. So will it be popular, Georgie? Well, we'll revisit it, no doubt, later on, a few weeks' time, and we'll see how much money's gone in. And I'd like NSNI to be open and transparent and tell us how much money has actually been poured into this. I'll ask in a couple of weeks' time, and let's find out.
Do let us know. And this Simon Lee talks there about you can invest and go green. What this sort of indicates to me a little bit is a lot of people saying the only reason you'd put your money in this is because of the green element. And it's that old idea that you can't possibly grow your money if you want it to be green. But that's not true, surely.
No, it's not true. And what's interesting about this rate is that it's far lower than we thought it was going to be. So we were very surprised when we learnt of this yesterday, when the release came out telling us what we were allowed to tell people at midnight. Because basically the government did this green gilts issuance recently, and that was at 0.87%. That was actually lower than it could have been because there was a wave of interest from people, institutional investors, into putting their money in there. It was massively oversubscribed. So they got away with offering it a lower rate than they would have done, and actually a lower rate than they would have had to do for a traditional normal gilt. The thinking was that they'd come in with a rate that was that or above. There was some controversy over it, because ultimately, if the government can raise money at 0.87% for green projects, and then it pays savers, say, like over 1%, it's actually paying more than it needs to for the money that it's raising. But there was a thought that it would try to reward savers for being green. It's a flagship product. There's a limited amount of money that can go in, that it almost would be a kind of loss leader on the whole idea of being green with your money, right? Boris Johnson was very clear this week. Investors need to act in order to tackle climate change. Governments can't do it alone. Governments can't afford to do it alone. The obvious direction that all of this is going in around the world is that governments are saying, we need to do something about this. We need to act. We need to act now. We need to act faster. We need to do something about it. You're kind of going to have to do a lot of the hard work here, guys. And that all feeds into trying to, you know, direct people's money into doing more of this. And actually, it can be quite profitable. There are some very successful investment funds, for example, that invest in the shares of companies that are involved in doing stuff that will make us less carbon intensive and less harmful to the planet. There are renewable energy investment trusts, for example, that pay out really nice dividends to people. Obviously, with the savings account, it's low risk. You expect less for your money on cash. It's protected and so on and so on. But we were still thinking we were going to get maybe a rate that was above that 0.87% of those gilts. And actually, we were probably thinking it was going to be above 1%, because let's face it, it's a three-year fix. So, and what people have got here is not even a half decent rate. They've got a third decent rate. It pays about a third of the best three-year fix. And as Lee said, those rates have been tickling up recently. We did ask our readers in the story, we gave them one of our favoured polls. Will you save into three-year NS&I green bonds at 0.65%? Overwhelmingly popular. 2% of readers said they would. That's one vote. I'm not sure who voted for this. And then 98%, the other 65 who'd voted, said no. Now, I can guarantee you that if that rate had been higher, the result on that probably would have been a bit different. But if you do want to put your money to work, what can you do in order to get a better return? Well, we've got an article today about green bonds in general. So you don't have to just have a green savings bond, where you would expect the rate to be lower because it's a savings account. You can get green government bonds, which we talked about, but those tend to be dominated by institutional investors. Or you can get green corporate bonds, where you're investing in the bonds of companies. And some of those green corporate bond funds have done, you know, quite well, and they will yield much higher levels. But people need to be aware that what they're doing there is taking a risk with their money in a way that they aren't with a savings account. With a savings account, you put all your money in, you get all your money back. With an investment fund, your investment may fall in value, or it may be fine. We've got some corporate green bond funds mentioned here: Aegon Ethical Corporate Bond, Eden Tree Responsible and Sustainable Sterling Bond Fund. Those yield 2.48% and 3.38% respectively. ETFs, the iShares Green Bond Index Fund, the largest green bond fund. It's got more than $3 billion in assets, and that has returned 3.52% in the last 3 years. That's not that much, really, is it, when you think about it? So then maybe you want to think about investing perhaps into a fund that invests into companies and into their shares. But then again, you're stepping up the risk ladder again. But some of those, to give examples, ones we've mentioned before, you've got Impact Environmental Markets, you've got Jupiter Green, you've got Octopus UK Future Generations. That we've done lots of articles on this. And if you go to thisismoney.co.uk/greeninvesting, you'll find some more ideas. But again, that's recognizing that you are stepping further up the risk ladder and taking a bit more risk with your money. But to reflect on something we talked about with the premium bonds thing last week about whether people hold too much in premium bonds, the maximum amount that you can put into one of these green savings bonds is £100,000. That's an awful lot of money to lock away for 3 years at a rate of 0.65%. And unless you have an exceptionally high salary and therefore need an exceptionally large rainy day pot to cover your 3 to 6 months worth of earnings, you should probably be thinking about doing something that will make your money work harder with a chunk of that £100,000, unless you've got a very good reason for needing that exact amount of money in 3 years' time.
Yeah. Be nice having 100,000. Anyway,
it'd be nice to have £100,000 that you could just drop into some paltry green bonds, paying you a much lower rate of return than a normal 3 year fix.
I'd suggest, if you are that sort of person and you are doing it because you want to be green, maybe speak to someone, a specialist who can help you, you know, do more with that in terms of green.
That's actually a really good point, Georgie. Sorry, thanks. Just to say, is that if you do actually have that kind of money and you do want to do something green with it, then, and you don't know what to do and you're not happy making the decisions yourself, then do speak to a financial advisor. Do get some financial advice. Do some financial planning. But say to them, I want to do something green or impactful with my money. And so I want you to come back and tell me what are the options, what I can do, and then grill them on exactly what those things are doing. Don't just go with the label. You want to know what that stuff is doing, because it's definitely a good idea to try to do some good with your money and make a profit. But as we've talked about quite a few times on the podcast recently, you've got to be really careful about where that money's actually going.
Indeed, you do. Listen to, was it last week's podcast? I can't remember, Simon. But you don't have to be super rich to speak to a financial advisor, nor to want to be green with your money. But that is a good piece of advice. I do want to talk more about the government's net zero strategy, though, because it affects more than just where we might put our £100,000 worth of cash savings. Lee, the government's net zero strategy, what's the point? How's it going to affect us?
Well, the point is, Georgie, is this date in the future, this 2050 date, to get Britain to zero emissions. You know, that's the whole game plan here. And this is what we're hearing a lot of noise about recently. And one of the key points of this as well is to reduce our reliance on imported fossil fuels. We've seen recently about, you know, energy prices spiking, you know, because a lot of that is we rely on overseas for it. So it's all of these kind of like plans and things in motion to try and reduce our emissions. And we've got a sort of 30-year time frame in which to do this. And the government has announced a number of measures, including things to do with property and mortgages, motoring, anything you can think of. It feels like they're throwing some ideas behind trying to reduce emissions. It's a noble cause, but how we get there is the big question. And it, as we've just been saying, it costs money. How much households are going to have to foot the bill for certain things is a difficult question when you have some people who are on incredibly low incomes, for example, or might live in properties that almost feel impossible to bring up to certain energy standards. So all of these wheels are in motion. It's been spoken about, it feels like, for quite a while now, this Build Back Better sort of initiative. We've got a meeting with world leaders next week, which it feels like only yesterday there was one of these meetings. But hey, look, if you know, things get done and they're worth doing, it just depends if these world leaders flying in their private jets and all of that kind of thing.
Because that's
what gets people riled up. You know, it's you know, one rule for them, one rule for us. Exactly. And I think that's where some people kind of get a little bit of a bee in their bonnet about this stuff. But yeah, there's been a number of measures that I'm sure we're about to talk about now.
Yeah, indeed. I think I was interviewing an expert in this who was very pro the fact that this can be done, lots of investment, doesn't have to be painful, and actually if companies don't go green, they'll lose out. But it does seem to me that needs to be a bit of honest discussion about this, about how much in the interim this is going to cost, because it's quite concerning for, you know, if you're a low-income household and you're reading some of the articles on your website, which talk about estate agents saying that, you know, many people may struggle to remortgage or to sell their homes if all of these proposals come in. I mean, we are going to have to pay for this somewhere, surely, to get to as much as, you know, investment can help, new jobs, all of that sort of thing.
Yeah, no, totally, Georgie. And that's why, you know, things like the old heat pump discussion again, which I feel like we went through a couple of months ago. But we said at the time when we were doing that podcast that, you know, there would need to be some sort of initiative for people, a grant for people to be interested in doing this. So this £5,000 grant is going to be available from next April for heat pumps to basically start replacing gas boilers. Now, gas boilers, I feel like, again, for years we've talked about gas boilers being banned and you know, how we're going to heat our homes alternatively, and, you know, new builds perhaps not having gas boilers anymore and having these heat pumps because it's easier to do it from the start rather than trying to, you know, adapt your home depending on what kind of home type you have. So this is £5,000 grant. It's going to be for 90,000 heat pumps to be installed. Now, that's a kind of drop in the ocean, isn't it, really? I mean, it's not going to make a huge amount of difference, but it gets there. What I'm quite interested about with this, though, and I was listening to an energy boss this week, the boss of Octopus, was talking about the more talk there is about this, the more innovation there will be in it. And all it will take is for some companies to actually go, do you know what, how do we make these things cheaper? You know, how do we bring down the cost of a heat pump that might cost somewhere between 10 and 20 grand? How do we get it to cost more like 5 grand, 8 grand? You know, and start bringing down the price as more people start to get them. So it becomes akin to how much it would cost to replace a gas boiler. You know, that's where I think it's quite interesting. There has to be that innovation. And surely if there's something like a heat pump in this country, because we're not really accustomed to having them, if companies start pouring in research and development into them and going, actually, it would take a James Dyson or someone to reinvent the heat pump. And then before you know it, you know, we think, why on earth didn't we have heat pumps? And that's where I think it's quite interesting. I think that's where people can kind of get on board and go, actually, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Look at it with electric cars. You know,
I was going to say, is that the same with electric cars?
Prime example here. I mean, you know, 5 years ago, I think early adopters, there were some early adopters in the technology, but a lot of people would have sat back and gone, I want to see prices come down. I want to see range go up. And that's exactly what's happened. You know, more people now are interested in getting an electric car. There's been more people that may have had their heads turned. You'll still have people in the camp that will go, don't want an electric car, don't believe in them. And that's the thing about, you know, it's about choice, isn't it? But you start putting rather than it being a choice, and you start actually forcing people to do it, it's a bit of a different matter. And then there was talks about, again, this is something that's been rumbling on, I would say, in the last 12 months we've been keeping an eye on, about green mortgages. So basically, the more energy efficient your home is, the better rate you might get, and the more lending you might get. But there's a problem in this country where 1.5 million homes probably can't get to C or above. So it starts at A, ends in G, G being the least efficient in the energy performance certificate rating. If you're in an old Victorian territory, we've had this chat before, it's going to be very difficult for you to get above that. And I think people that are living in those homes, or perhaps living in a flat, for example, where a heat pump might be a bit more difficult to install. I think these people want to know, in their specific circumstances, how they can make these things happen. Now, we've seen a number of major lenders in the last 12 to 18 months sort of start putting these green mortgages out and offering sort of slightly beneficial rates. That starts becoming more scaled up, and the government are talking here about lenders having to keep track on their whole lending book of what EPC rating their mortgage book is. There's going to be pressure for major lenders to push that up as high as they can. And then it might start penalising people in homes that just simply can't get there. So I think, you know, broadly speaking, this is all a noble cause, and you know, we should be looking to reduce emissions. You know, we should be world leading in this. I can't see why we wouldn't want that. But it's very hard to broadly sweep and make absolutely everyone in Britain, you know, zero emissions free. I think it's a really difficult task. And it's those people in those kind of homes, low incomes, are potentially going to get left behind. I don't know how you can penalise those people.
That's our homes, Simon. We've also got to get cars sorted out as well. Are we in a better place there? As part of this whole plan doodah that we're getting from the government, there's also the idea that manufacturers could be forced to sell more electric vehicles each year or face a fine. What's that about?
Yes. So the idea is a zero emissions mandate. Basically, the idea is force car makers to sell a greater chunk of electric cars every year, right? So what you don't do is you say you're just going to ban them from a certain petrol and diesel cars from a certain date, solely petrol and diesel cars, I should say, hybrids still allowed in the mix. And then you just ignore it. And then you get to a few days before and you go, right, all right, guys, how many are you selling? And they go, now we're still selling loads of petrol cars. Everybody wants to buy them before the ban comes in. They won't be selling diesel cars. Nobody wants those at the moment. So you try to force them to sell more each year. I mean, this plays right into the car industry's hands anyway, to be perfectly honest, because I think that the motor industry, in all honesty, after being initially quite sceptic on quite a lot of this shift to electric cars, has woken up to the fact that this is a uniquely good opportunity for it. Because what you have is governments and authorities actively encouraging people with a carrot and sometimes with a really big stick, like the ULEZ that's coming into London on Monday, to go out and buy new cars. And people are going, yeah, actually, maybe I will, because actually maybe that new car will save me some money because I won't have to spend so much money on petrol. And so on. And if it wasn't for the fact that actually it's quite difficult to get your hands on a new car right now, I would imagine that the car makers would be selling even more electric cars than they are at the moment. So I don't think that this is really much of an issue whatsoever for car makers and the motoring industry. And in fact, I think that we're going to see a bit of a boom in the motoring industry. Certainly if I look around me, I'm seeing huge numbers of electric cars on the roads now. I'm seeing a lot of Tesla Model 3s, the more affordable of the Teslas, loads of VW ID3s, which are more affordable than those. I'm seeing quite a few Peugeot E208s. And I'm also starting to see some Hyundai Ioniq 5s, which is a pretty futuristic looking car that is actually very, very good and a good alternative to a Tesla. And as the cost of them comes down and the cost narrows between a petrol car and an electric car, I think that's what's going to really shift it. And people will find that they're saving money off the back of it. So yeah, I think that this is, it's almost a case of like making yourself look good by stating the bleeding obvious.
Yeah. I think we need an Elon Musk effect on heat pumps. What's he up to at the moment? Maybe he's got some spare time.
In all honesty, I think what we need to do is try to harness some of the hot air that comes out of Boris Johnson's mouth to heat our homes and we wouldn't have a problem.
Marvellous. Right, we revealed the green bond savings rate, pretty paltry. Also, I suppose a little bit of disappointment is for pensioners. I mean, you would think a 3.1% rise in line with September's inflation figures, the full amount that the state pension will go up by a week from next April, £5.55. You would think that 3.1% is all right, but it's sort of like that. Here's what you could have won. It's not quite the 8.3% rise in average earnings after the government suspended the triple lock formula for 1 year. Lee, one commentator on your article pointed out, against the backdrop of even higher inflation on areas that hit the elderly hard, such as heating bills and food prices, you have the makings of a serious national crisis in the cost of living looming. Do we?
I can see completely the logic behind that. And actually, trust the inflation, the sort of, it's been completely soaring in recent months. And then bet your bottom dollar when it's going to set the pension, state pension rate, it dips a little bit. It goes down to 3.1%, which really sort of has irked people, you know. I can totally understand that because energy bills, for example, we're seeing energy bills rising. Petrol prices, local petrol station here is now at beyond the record price from April 2012. We're seeing inflationary pressures on shopping at the supermarket. We've seen Unilever this morning saying, you know, the prices of products are going to go up. I think I saw Marmite was going to go up something like 5%. Okay, a jar of Marmite, that's one example of loads of things that you might get in your supermarket shop that you are going to now start finding is more expensive. And people will argue that the rise of £5.55 a week, which will come in April 2022 for the full state pension, doesn't go far enough. And it is a case of here's what you could have won, because, you know, the triple lock has basically that manifesto pledge has been abandoned for the year, which would have seen it go up beyond 8%. And actually crunching figures, and that means those on full state pension, that's £500 less than they would have got if the triple lock had been promised, but if the promise had been kept. But you know, it's a kind of a difficult one for the government, because if they're seen as being too generous to pensioners, you know, younger people are like, oh, you know, there's pensioners are already doing all right, aren't they? But then pensioners are saying, well, hold on a minute, you know, a lot of people we're struggling. And struggling with rises that aren't good enough. Now, you know, it is a tough one. We were looking back actually at how this has changed basically over the year, and over the years, over the last decade, and it is the third biggest rise in the last decade. But people, our readers, I think the poll that we had 22,000 votes on it at last count as to whether or not it should have been honoured, and something like 90-odd% said it should have been honoured. And you know what's saying there about younger people, I mean, at the end of the day, if the state pension goes up, it's only going to benefit you when you get to state pension age, because it would have gone up, but who knows what the landscape looks like, you know.
There's a lot of young people who don't think they're going to get a state pension.
Well, there was some research last week suggesting that, you know, and how that looks in the future, and that's where that kind of friction lay, I guess. But I don't know. I kind of feel like the government kind of got away with it a little bit. It didn't really feel like it was like the biggest impactful news of the week, which is quite, I don't know. I thought there was going to be a bit more kind of blowback on it.
But we already knew, didn't we? We already knew that they weren't going to go up in line with wage. We already knew that they were suspending the triple lock. Heck, we already knew that they were going to break the manifesto promise with tax rises, national insurance and all that sort of thing.
But there's one thing knowing it, and then there's one thing it actually happening on the day and people going, wow, no, actually that has happened. Do you see what I mean? Sometimes you talk about the future and people don't really kind of cotton on until the moment it happens. And that's why I was a little bit surprised. And I remember saying in this podcast a couple of months ago, and you said how much you think it will go up by. And I said maybe about 5%. I actually think 5% would have probably been the right figure. You know, basically meeting in the middle, a bit of compromise between the inflation figure and the earnings figure. And maybe it would have softened the blow a little bit. And actually, I would have gone with that. I think that would have been a relatively fair thing to do, especially in a time in which things look like they're going to be getting more expensive in the short to medium term.
Yeah, I think I said it was 3.2, but anyway, 3.1 it is. Is Bitcoin back? Cryptocurrency has taken a bit of a relative battering of late. It's up to $66,000 a coin after the first US exchange traded fund proved popular with investors. But what exactly is ProShares Bitcoin Strategy EFT? Simon, what's going on? And what's been going on as well?
That will be a US Bitcoin ETF to tackle the question first. It is the first proper US Bitcoin ETF that people can invest in. It means that people can now invest in Bitcoin through the safety of an exchange traded fund, which is a fund that is traded on the stock market, rather than having to get themselves a crypto wallet or back it through other means. It's possible to do it through like kind of pooled nominee accounts with some places that you don't actually have to have your own crypto wallet. This has been one of the things responsible for Bitcoin's run up to another high. It's actually fallen back since reaching its highest level this week, and it's now at $63,073.79 as we speak. Don't expect it to remain there for longer than a few seconds. But it's one of those things where Bitcoin and crypto moves in waves. Like with many markets, the waves just happen to come a lot faster than they do in many other markets. And I mean, we saw a big, big run up to a peak in April. We then saw the price come down really quite heavily. We've seen another couple of runs, etc. And we're now on a high. The question is, does this continue towards the end of the year? Do we get up to, there was talk, people were banging on earlier this year, Bitcoin $100,000. This year, 2021, Bitcoin $100,000. Is that going to happen? I mean, literally, who knows? There's just as much chance that we could end 2021 with Bitcoin $30,000, okay? Because it got down in July to just below $30,000. There's some people out there saying, I'm waiting for 20, I'm going to buy at 20. Anybody who bought 30 has done very well. But anybody who bought in April at 60 would have been looking at it in July at 30 going, oh no, maybe I should cut my losses. The answer to this is, you know, you don't have to be a true believer in Bitcoin being the future of the world and fiat currency being ultimately doomed to think that maybe you should hold some Bitcoin in your portfolio. You should be holding a small amount because it is highly volatile. And even just holding 5% can dramatically increase the volatility of your portfolio. There are obviously other crypto assets out there that people are pretty interested in, ranging from Ethereum, which Ether is what powers the Ethereum network. The Ethereum network is a blockchain network on which a lot of stuff that people are doing with this technology for future ideas of how you can improve the things we do now, but decentralize them so that rather than all running through one gigantic company, as they do at the moment, for example, most of the internet is currently run by people like Amazon through its Amazon Web Services. It could be decentralized. Look at that outage with Facebook the other day when all of the Facebook services went down. Now, if Facebook was run on a decentralized network, that wouldn't have happened. Okay, it all came about because it's all coming from one point. And the Ethereum network is considered to be maybe one of the places where that will come out of. Then you've got other coins. You've got your Cardanos and things like that. And then you've got your absolute, well, we know what they're called. It's a rude word, coins. It's another word for poo. The shit coins, right? The Doge coins, the Shiba Inus, the are they a joke coin? But hang on a minute, how did that joke go up by 1,000%? Maybe I should have bought that joke. It's a wild west out there, and there is the suggestion actually from some people within, some sensible people within the crypto industry, that all of this price stuff going on, this rocketing up, rocketing down, you know, especially with the shit coins, is really not helping with people taking cryptocurrencies themselves and also the blockchain and the associated technologies seriously.
Yeah. Lee, if only podcasts were visual, because I think your head's about to fall off. You were nodding so much during that. What are you nodding about, Lee?
No, I've been giving it a lot of thought this week, Georgie, actually, about these sort of meme coins, you know, like your Doge coins and things, because I think there is that danger of people see things like that and go, actually, cryptocurrencies are a load of nonsense, because what does something like Dogecoin actually do? And what happens is these coins get created, and the creators are hoping that they're going to get traction. And then as that traction builds and people pile into it, the price goes up and up and up. And it inevitably feels a bit like a pyramid scheme in that sense. But that's just one part of the crypto market, and it's not a huge part of the crypto market, but it takes up quite a lot of the kind of social media space. And the reason why I was nodding along actually is because I'll give you my crypto story very quickly. This time last year, I dabbled in a little bit of bars in Bitcoin on Coinbase, mainly just out of a kind of experiment to see what would happen, how easy it was to open a Coinbase account, all of that kind of thing. And actually, I was waiting for a certain point in which to cash out my exposure. Now, when I say my exposure to this, and Simon was talking about his, you know, making it a small part of your portfolio, I put £80 in, right? So I'm not talking about anything that is life changing, just to have a bit of skin in the game, just to see what you know, what it's all about. Now, what I found myself doing this week, actually, Bitcoin, when it hit $65,000, I cashed out my exposure. So that's my 80 quid gone. And then I've actually diversified my Coinbase portfolio that started at 80 quid and risen up to something like, it'd be on £400, you know, it's not to be sniffed at.
No.
Withdrawn exposure. I've kept the large chunk of it in Bitcoin. And then I've put a little bit into Ethereum, like the next biggest holding. And then I've put a bit in Cardano, probably half again. And then I've gone for a bit of a speculative coin, which is called Atom Coin. Now, the reason why I've picked those things, it's because I've actually gone away and read about them. And actually, Coinbase is pretty good for that. It does have all of the info in there, the white papers, there's all links to the information that you need to read about these things. And some of them actually feel like they could be solving problems, you know, and that's what I think I'm trying to get at here. It's good to go and have a read about these different coins. And a lot of people just go, crypto, it's dangerous and it's a load of rubbish. And I can totally understand that point of view. And especially this week, we've seen the FCA come out with this new scam, an InvestSmart campaign aimed at younger people who might be doing things like getting involved in Dogecoin, hoping it's going to go up in value, then cashing out and treating it like gambling and like a game. And it, to be honest, it is a little bit like gambling, and I couldn't sit here and recommend that you go off and do it. But all I'm saying is I put a little bit of skin in the game. I've had a little read around, and you know, if I lost all of my money, if that £400 turned to zero tomorrow, you know, I'm not going to lose any sleep over it, because exposure in it.
I was going to say, you did the very sensible thing, which is whatever you've put in, you've now taken out. Thank goodness it went up, so you could do that. And whatever you've kind of got left is almost a bonus, I guess. And it's educational, it sounds like, for you.
Well, exactly. I've actually really quite enjoyed just going out and reading about the different coins and actually saying, yeah, this sounds quite interesting. I wouldn't say I've given it huge realms of thought that I would do in terms of like diversifying my investment portfolio or my pension, you know, looking at different funds and things. More kind of like just what's out there and what's interesting. And I'm not looking to like basically pour all of my money into some coin that's right at the beginning, hoping it's going to go up 1,000% in a year, which is what a lot of people inevitably are doing. You know, and that's where people get burnt, because if that doesn't happen, and it goes down and whatnot, and you lose money that you couldn't have afforded to lose, then, you know, it's not good. So basically, make it a really, 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 really tiny part of your portfolio if you're interested in it and you're willing to go away and do the research. If you're not, I wouldn't do it.
It seems, Simon, that for every government or regulatory crackdown or warning, or even businesses that say they love it and then pull back a little bit, or certain individuals that do that, it still keeps coming at us. But when are we actually going to see the value? Maybe I'm missing the point here, but when are we actually going to see it being used transactionally in any other way than just what seems to be sentiment driven? I'm going to get a lot of hammering here from people who are crypto fanatics saying, what do you mean it doesn't mean anything at the moment? But at the minute, it just seems very emotionally driven without any real substance. Is that fair?
I am by no means any form of crypto expert, although we have spent many, many years covering cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin on This Is Money. My understanding, and I stand to be corrected, is that actually Bitcoin isn't that great as a currency, you know, for transactions. Broadly speaking, it's not the future of money, because it's much more clunky. The way that the block is verified on the blockchain, its structure means that it's very energy intensive, as people know. It requires a lot of computing power. That takes time, and you're better off just using the actual traditional financial system if you want to move some money around.
So it's just a commodity, is it
digital gold? Now, gold is also fairly useless as a currency. I mean, you could use it, you can pay for stuff with it, you can transact with it. People did thousands of years ago, but then people started to invent paper money because it was just, well, it was more useful than using gold and bits of gold or gold coins and stuff like that. But gold is a long-term store of value. The question is, like, can Bitcoin be digital gold? I don't know. Ask me in 2,000 years' time and I'll tell you the answer. But with every bit of news, event, that kind of thing that you just talked about, with every year that passes, all these kind of things and so on, it builds up more and more of a case for being digital gold. It's still there, it's still knocking around, it hasn't totally blown up. Can you describe something where the price is so wildly volatile as digital gold in the sense of gold? Well, the gold price can be pretty volatile, and the gold price is driven by sentiment and speculation as well. The Bitcoin price is a lot more volatile than gold, however, certainly in recent years. As I said, you won't know whether it's digital gold for thousands of years. That's the run up that gold has to this kind of thing. You've still got people out there who are hugely dubious on gold. Warren Buffett, okay, the world's most famous investor, is a strictly don't buy gold man.
Yeah.
So
is he a Bitcoin fan?
I don't think he's a Bitcoin fan either. No, he was pretty down on it. No, he's a put your money into companies that can display they are putting it to productive use and growing profits over time kind of guy. But he's not really that into dividends either, in all honesty. He thinks companies should be reinvesting their money to grow their profits and grow the share price and stuff like that. But just because Warren Buffett thinks something doesn't mean that it's,
of course,
100% right. But yeah. Yeah, it's don't think about the use it as money instead of your pounds thing. Right. Think of it as the comparison to gold thing, but you know, you've got thousands of years before you're gonna know that.
All right then. Well, we'll let you know in 1,000 or so years. Lee, finally, I've struggled, really struggled, to write an in into this next story. I'm totally stumped. It seems like the gift that would keep giving comedy wise and I thought, I can't do any more than what your article has said. Quote, I fished my daughter's third birthday present out of a skip. Toy shortage this Christmas. Thank goodness, says Lee Boyce. Lee, look, I know I've been away in Spain for some time, but I didn't realise things had got quite so bad for you and the UK. What's going on here, Lee?
No, Georgie, it's a mentality shift. That's what it is. It's not that things haven't got bad. Look, this is, I'll quickly really talk about this, right? So it's my daughter's birthday next month. Now, it's difficult being a parent and trying to keep things green, right? Kids are just about as anti-green as you can possibly imagine. You know, between ages of 0 to 3, the disposable nappies, the half-eaten meals, and one of the real bugbears is just the realms of plastic tap that exist, the absolute nonsensical toys and things that are just have no whatsoever, right? So we've been hearing about all sorts of things in the last couple of weeks, and I won't go too far down that rabbit hole. One of the things is toys, and there's been various stories in the media of stressed out looking parents coming out with bags and trolleys loads from, you know, famous big toy retailers. I was watching a very famous TV morning show recently, and they were interviewing parents that have bought thousands of pounds of Christmas presents already for their children. And I just think, wow, like, you know, sometimes it just gets to me and I think, what is this all about? And this isn't the meaning of Christmas. It's not the meaning of anything. You know, what are we teaching our children when we're doing that? But that's not me to shame these children. If you want to spoil your children, that's your prerogative. I spoil my child in different ways than buying a load of plastic tat. And this is where I'm trying to get to with this story, basically.
I get the sentiment, Lee. Yeah. I don't get the location.
Okay, so
there's charity shops you could go to. I mean, a skip.
Well, listen, I was walking home from the coffee shop. In fact, after recording this podcast a little while ago, and I was walking back from the coffee shop, and a skip had this shiny pink bike in it, and I thought,
"Wow,
throwing that bike out? Why are you throwing that bike out? That is crazy." But I knocked on the door, which I think is what you should do in these kinds of scenarios, and it just turned out that the people were moving house and they left everything to the last minute, as inevitably a lot of us do, and they'd hired a skip and they just threw out anything that wasn't coming with them, including this bike that their daughter had massively outgrown and hardly used. And I said, do you mind if I take it home? You know, my daughter's been asking me for a bike. I was going to go and get one, but this is perfect. You know, she likes Disney princesses. This looks great. And they were like, that's great. It's nice that it's going to a new home. Instead of it going to landfill, I took it home. I've given it a clean up. I've tightened the bolts. I bought a couple of some tassels for a couple of quid, stuck them in, and it looks as good as new. And, you know, that's the bike. She's already got a balance bike anyway that we sourced off Facebook Marketplace for a couple of quid. And now she will upgrade to this bike. I'll sell that balance bike back off onto Facebook Marketplace for a couple of quid. And it's full circular economy in motion. And that's where I was trying to get at with this. So we've all been there, Georgie. You know, I'm an uncle to a lot of nieces and nephews and lots of family friends and things. And you get stumped what to buy for birthday presents and Christmas gifts. And it all becomes one big mess, right? And actually, we just put down some ground rules a couple of years back for our friends and for our family. And it's not us being militant. It's not being like, no, when you get this present. It's more grandparents especially, you know, they love to spoil the grandchildren, rightly so. And I totally understand that. But it's when they start bringing presents and realms and realms and realms of stuff and it piles up. And I don't live in the biggest house. So it's kind of like, you know, we just live in a 3-bed semi. We don't need any more toys in here. Yeah. You know, you have to throw stuff out before getting stuff in. So what we've been doing, instead of throwing that stuff out, is listing it on Facebook Marketplace. I've become a massive Facebook Marketplace fan. It's free to use. You list it up almost like eBay, and people come around, give you cold hard cash for stuff that you were going to want to get rid of anyway. We take that money, I put it into a secondary bank account, and that becomes the new present kitty. That's quite sensible advice, right? I mean, you've then got that money. We'll go and source some stuff. We will buy our daughter some brand new stuff. I'm not sitting here saying I wouldn't, but Facebook Marketplace is definitely our friend. Secondhand, independent shops, love all that. And we tell her grandparents and we tell family, and we're always a bit stumped what to buy and things anyway. We just have a rule of three, basically. Either buy one present, preferably wooden, send her some money that I'll put into her investment account, which is great because her investment account is doing absolute great guns, where some of the money that would have gone onto plastic TAT has actually gone to use into an investment account and that's growing as a result, or go and take her for an experience. Nice. You know, go and take her somewhere, nice, somewhere locally that's going to enhance and enrich her life rather than just a huge pile of TAT. So yeah, and basically in this story as well, I gave some tips about using Facebook Marketplace. I think people kind of get a bit put off because they think it's a bit like eBay, and I don't use eBay. You know, the thought of going to post things off and all of that, I just know I wouldn't do it. So I would say make it part of your day. So list things, know when you're going to be indoors, because if you start doing it at weekends and evenings, it will get on your nerves, because if people don't show up and stuff, it just encroaches on your time. You can take quick listings, a couple of photographs. You can do it while watching the television. It takes no time at all. Put that money into a secondary account so you can tangibly see that pot growing and use it for, you know, good stuff. You could build contacts on your doorstep. Someone turned up, picked up this wooden rocking horse that sold for £5 that Britt never used. It was just given to us. And she ran a nursery and she was like, this is great. I've been looking for all of these. Can I take your details for future stuff that you're putting up? Of course. So, you know, it's great. If you're in a populous area, there's lots of potential buyers and stuff that you think won't sell probably will. So like I put a Dyson vacuum cleaner up for sale for £25, right? Years of use I've had out of that. Mm. And honestly, that was going to go to the skip. I couldn't see anyone really wanting to come and buy that. It's clunky. It plugs into the wall. No one wants to plug into the wall Hoover really anymore. Someone came around, asked me to demo it on the doorstep, plugged it in, showed it. Lovely. £25 in my pocket. Went and carried it into the car for them. Bosh, done.
Yeah.
And I love all that kind of stuff. I would just encourage people to think about not throwing things out and just trying to sell a few things. Yeah. Even if you're new to doing this, and then it's kind of rewarding. And as my daughter grows up, I will tell her this is kind of how we get new things in, you know. Yeah. And she's already been at the doorstep a couple of times when I've sold a couple of things on, you know, old books of hers that she's outgrown. You know, she's just a bit older now, so she sees it going. I said, that's going to a new home. This is the money we've got from it, and this money can now go and to buy you new stuff. And she's getting it, and I like that.
I wonder, with the sort of climate issue going the direction we're going, the green agenda and stuff, actually, Brooke will be telling you in a few years, Dad, come on, don't buy me anything new. And this will be the way that kids grow up. I'm actually moving home at the moment, Lee. I've already done 6 bags to charity shops. I've got a little pile of, the other half thinks I'm crazy, a little pile of gifts to give for Christmas, of things like, you know, books that are pretty brand new, a dress for my mum that I've never worn that'll fit her, you know, a pair of gloves that I think it's from last year. The key to re-gifting, though, is to make a note on who gave it to you, because I've got a bit of a dilemma. I was about to give my brother a book and then realised it was about Trotsky. I'd actually stolen it from him, so that I couldn't give back. But I imagine with, you know, I sadly don't have kids, but would they notice if you just sort of rewrapped something you gave them, you know, maybe spray it a different color, or, you know, Lee, could you?
It depends. It depends how switched on your child is, I guess. I mean, yeah. I can't imagine getting away with that with my daughter. And sometimes, like, you know, if we get secondhand, like I'm thinking about the Balance bike, for example, for a couple of pounds, it looked brand new, but it was just a tiny mark on it. And she said, what's that tiny mark? And it's kind of like, well, it has already had one careful owner. And then she sits there and uses it, and it's, what does it matter?
Yeah.
It still functions. And anything that we buy that way, or rescue from skips or whatever, I will just either let it go for free, like how I've got it, or I might even make a little profit on it by selling it back off Facebook Marketplace. Hopefully another child will use it, and then another child will use it, and the process keeps on going. And I think that there needs to be a little bit more of that in certain ways. And talking about a toy shortage, I went into 2 toy shops over the weekend in Chelmsford, near where I live. And it was just wall to ceiling with plastic TAT. It was like a headache in the shop. And I was I was pleased to get out of there. I didn't pick up anything. I don't know how those shops operate. Honestly, I don't know how you take a child in there. I mean, wow, it's just like sensory overload. I mean, you know, it doesn't look like there's a toy shortage to me. Maybe of certain popular toys, but that's been going on forever. I mean, that's even in Jingle All the Way with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Turbo.
Do you remember Buzz Lightyear? Yeah. They can get that for love nor money in 1995 or something, whatever that was.
There's always these things that are popular and before Christmas. And, you know, I just think that a more scaled back Christmas for me is the one, and we enjoy it more. And you know, I'm not, as I say, this is not me preaching or lecturing people. It's Christmas. You go and do whatever the hell you want for your children, however you want to spoil them. This is just our own system. It's what I do. You can always tell your children that, you know, it's been a scarred down Christmas because there's been a toy shortage, and then just forward them on some articles.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Absolutely. Educate them in the process. That's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, including a skip. Or I'd love to know, have you found a present anywhere really random like Lee? Simon?
No, I haven't. But you're not directly asking me, are you? I do have a friend though, who when he was living in a flat some years back in Clapton, used to regularly manage to pick stuff up to the point where he'd kind of pretty much furnished his entire home with stuff that had been found, that had been skip dipped, including a rather fantastic bamboo clad bar that was in the corner of the living room, which was great because it was a proper party flat at the time. But he was once visited by a bailiff to do with an unpaid debt. And the guy went round writing down on a piece of paper all of the items that he could see and what they were worth. He was obviously ranking them as like what they might cost. And my friend was just sitting there silently thinking, yeah, got that from Skip. Yeah, got that from Skip. Anyway, you can email us your skip dipping stories at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join the debate and read your comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.